Hello and welcome to the Growing Leaders podcast. Mary here alongside our resident movie buff and fearless leader, Dr. Tim Elmore. Tim, we have the honor of having many esteemed and privileged guests on our podcast, but today might be an extra special day. We get to welcome to the podcast your son, Jonathan. And Jonathan is a recent graduate of Biola University, back in Los Angeles, California, and has now shifted into his full-time career back here in Georgia. And we're just excited to be able to have some dialogue between father and son about what it means to grow up as an adult in today's complex world. So we're looking forward to this conversation.
Thanks, Mary. I am excited today to have my son, Jonathan. Welcome. Glad you're here.
Yes, me too.
So we're talking about this whole idea of maturation. What does it mean to be a kid today who moves through childhood, adolescence, and then early adulthood, and what makes it so hard? So let me start with an observation I've made over the last couple of years.
Okay.
And one that's going to go into the brand new book that we'll be releasing at Growing Leaders called Marching Off the Map. Early on, I make this observation. It seems to me like I'm seeing more and more the extinction of childlikeness, meaning the loss of wonder and innocence and trust early on, but then the extension of childishness, the avoidance of responsibility and self-regulation and all the stuff that we thought when you're 18, you should do that. So I know this is overspeak, but I want to toss this to you. Do you see what I see? Do you see both of those realities going on?
Absolutely. I think I even recognize childlikeness and childishness in my life almost at all times. It's like, I do want to work on this. I want to protect this. But I think giving a little bit of context about me would be a little bit helpful. I grew up a very shy, sensitive kid, and You guys were so great to allow me to have margin, which it was hard to have, especially as technology and social media was growing. You allowed me to have lots of margin to experiment with things that I was interested in, to play around with things I already saw. I think I might be good at this. And it allowed a lot of creative space for me to find out some things about me, which I didn't know earlier. And you guys were so good at allowing me to be a part of a community theater. That was huge, just a huge outlet to pull me into who I actually was and discover those things. One little quirk about me was that I watched Disney movies on the constant, like when I was a kid. And usually, you know, you stop when you get to like 11 or 12, and I was kind of still watching them. And but I was doing it in a way that was authentic. I mean, I was watching it as 13-year-old Jonathan, and then later I was watching it as a high school. So it was, I was interpreting the messages in the movies differently. But that definitely, I think I remember having a conversation with you in the basement once where you even put together, Jonathan, you might be protecting, inadvertently protecting your innocence just by watching these movies, watching fairy tales, getting engaged with those. I think that was a huge, huge thing. But so that's kind of the childlikeness that I saw as I was growing up, but the childishness, definitely being out on my own and getting to stretch my legs. I was lazy, and I was there were definitely times where I was just wanting to hold on to my boyhood, my maybe immature side a little bit. So,
well, you've talked about even friends that they're not ready to leave home or whatever, that happens. But you mentioned a movie. Mention that real quick.
Well, as we were talking about this, I was thinking about a movie. I think it came out a few years ago called Her. It was a Spike Jonze, Jones film. I'm trying to say that name right, but it was the main lead actor, and it was Joaquin Phoenix. Maybe some of you remember.
Yeah.
It. The synopsis of the story is kind of a parable of today's world, today's culture, where you have a character who is totally disengaged from the world, and really they're stuck on technology. And they're trying to find something real, something authentic, but all he has is this little piece of this computer, and he begins to have a relationship with her, and that's why the movie is called Her. But there was a line in the movie that, when I heard it, it just stuck with me. It spoke into what I felt like I was feeling at age 20. So this, just keep in mind, I was 20 years old. Sometimes I think I have felt everything I'm ever gonna feel. And from here on out, I'm not gonna feel anything new, just lesser versions of what I've already felt. And I walked out of the theater. I was with a friend of mine, and we talked about that line. And I think because we've become so inundated with so much content, our phones, our social life is on our phones. Everything is right there.
Yeah.
we're just so oversaturated with so much information. There's nothing that surprises us anymore. Yeah. There's no room for curiosity or discovery or, you know, optimism even, where you feel like you can go out in the world and find something new, you know? Yeah. So that was a really interesting moment for me. Yeah.
I remember Dr. Tony Campolo, a sociologist from Eastern College, said something years ago that I've never forgotten. Mm-hmm. He said, "I don't think we live in a generation of bad kids. I think we live in a generation of kids who know too much too soon." Mm-hmm. And you do have this feeling of, this is it. I remember talking to a NCAA Division I volleyball player who her senior year, she said, "I'm so afraid that my best days are behind me now.
Crazy.
This is my best days."
It's crazy.
And I'm thinking, you've got your whole life ahead of you.
I know.
But you feel that way when you've been overexposed to so much. You've been overseas. You've done the backpack thing. You've done the Disney World trip. And now it's like, what is there left to do? So you've mourned this a little bit, even 24 years into your life. You've mourned this dilemma. You know it's time to become a man now. We've talked about that, and I've been so excited about the steps you've taken. But you've dreaded the loss of some childhood realities. You know, you must learn to self-regulate and pay bills and be responsible.
Yeah, right.
But does that mean we lose everything we loved about childhood? Sometimes baby boomers, my generation, would say, yes, that's why they call it work. You're supposed to go to work and grind it away, and you're having too much fun when you're 25 years old. And I think that's not helpful either. Mm-hmm. Talk about how you've thought, I don't think we're supposed to lose everything about the childhood thing.
Well, first I'd like to say, I think there's a way, and hopefully we've kind of touched on this already, that there's a way to be childlike, but also emotionally intelligent. You can actually be responsible.
Yeah.
Still working on that part. Still working on the paying the bills whole part. But there's a way. There is a way. And I think that it's when you have both parts, you're fully formed into an emotionally intelligent adult. You're holding on to these very human things that you started in your childhood that you kind of drop off because you think you ought to. I love this old quote from C.S. Lewis, the author, where he says, "One day we will all be old enough to start reading fairy tales again." And that was something that for me, when I read it, I was like, "Yeah, that's true." I was already watching Disney movies. Way well into my adult years, but in fact, while I was in school, I was still reading a lot of the books that I read as a kid, and I kind of wanted to have one final, I don't know, hurrah with these stories before I entered adulthood. And I moved completely across the country. I moved from Atlanta all the way to Los Angeles. So I found I needed to have some breathing room where I could just refocus myself. And a way I did that was, as I was going through my classes doing screenwriting, because that was my major, I found that I was able to tug on those kind of childlike, maybe even pretend a little bit as I was writing, and I was able to play and have my own kind of get quiet a little bit and remove the phone, remove different things, and really kind of echo back to how I was when I was a kid.
No doubt about it. And as you were talking, I was thinking, and actually every one of us goes through this.
Right.
In every life station, there are parts of us that still long for that wonder and that trust that we seem to have lost, innocence lost, you know?
Yeah.
We were talking before about how we'll catch ourselves singing in the shower. That's probably the safest place to be a child again, or to pretend like you're Justin Bieber. You're singing in the shower, or have we all driven up to a stoplight? We look over at the car next to us, someone's singing in the car.
All, full out.
Like, full on. Yes, they're committed. They've committed. Yeah, they're not phoning in. This is real. And you catch them, and they suddenly get embarrassed. But what they're doing is they're just stepping out of the realities that they're in. We all want this, and we try to find ways, even if it's pretending, to do it. So I'd like to jump into how culture fosters this.
Sure.
We were talking earlier. You are, Mary calls me the movie buff. You're really the movie buff of our family. It seems like movies will allude to this. You mentioned her earlier as kind of the downside of this. But talk for a minute about movies, particularly at Christmas time. We see this theme that we're talking about introduced on the silver screen.
Well, isn't it true where what you just said, Christmas, Charlie Brown Christmas, A Christmas Carol, The Grinch, there's a lot of themes of trying to reclaim that sense of wonder and thinking everything's going to be okay, you know, innocence, all those things.
Yep.
So I remember this Christmas, our family loves the Jim Carrey version of The Grinch, directed by Ron Howard. You know, it's just so fun.
It's great, yeah.
But we really started to talk, and of course, it's a kid's movie, but we spend hours afterwards trying to evaluate it.
Yeah, it's true. That's what we do in our home.
That's
we debrief and do some critical thinking about the script.
Exactly, yeah. So we just lost half our audience. But
yes, we did.
So in that movie, there's the challenge of losing the best part of ourselves.
Yeah.
The Grinch character himself, even though it wasn't in that original Dr. Seuss book, Ron Howard kind of tugged on these things that we all recognize.
Yeah.
And Cindy Lou Who, she sings the iconic song, Where Are You Christmas? Almost like asking, singing out, saying, where is this innocence that I felt like I had once and it's suddenly gone?
And she's only like 8 years old.
Right.
But the whole town has got caught up in materialism, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And the Grinch is the epitome of the other side of this. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, Ron Howard has her connect with the Grinch. Mm-hmm. And again, it's a fairy tale, but and she introduces the whole city back to, you don't have to lose this even if you grow older.
And you know what's interesting? I'm remembering even notes from Ron Howard as he was making this movie. He was saying, you know what? When you look at the Grinch story, the Grinch character is actually right in his assumptions at the beginning of the story.
Yeah.
The world, the Whoville world below him was all fake. And it was
and
totally artificial.
And, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
It was all bright and colorful, but there was no meat, no depth behind it.
Yeah, no doubt. So let me real quick define what childlike means, because I think there is a difference between childlike and childish.
Yeah.
I think maturation means we grow out of childishness, but we never lose our childlikeness. I think that's the key to being fully aware at 40 years old. When I'm in the grocery store and I'm not frustrated at the slow line, I can fully experience the moment. We need to get that. And I don't want you to lose that. I don't want your sister to lose that as you age. So for me, a definition of childlike means there is still a sense of innocence. I still trust people, not naively, but I'm going to believe the best about people. Choosing to trust. We talked about that phrase yesterday where you work. Mm-hmm. We don't lose our curiosity. In the education world, we talk about lifelong learners. Well, how many of us are lifelong?
Right.
Not many.
Right.
We stop reading books, and we're jaded and cynical, and we suspect the worst when Nancy down the hallway did that or said that. So I want us, before we're done here, to talk about how do we keep the childlikeness when we turn 40, 45, 50, 55, and in my case, a little bit older than that. We stop having fun doing life.
Yeah,
things just kind of slip away. And as you just mentioned, materialism, narcissism, the exposure to negative information just plays a huge role. So, Jonathan, there's another movie. We've got a million of them, don't we, in our heads?
Yes.
But there's another one that's probably the classic story. I talk about it often in events that I do. But describe this movie and what's the real secret behind the plot?
Well, as we began to talk about this topic, the story of Peter Pan just comes to the forefront of your mind, doesn't it? The original story written by J.M. Barrie probably is a little more, it hits this topic pretty much center stage. And when we think about Peter Pan, don't we think about that main conflict being between Peter Pan and Captain Hook and the Lost Boy, all those all that stuff? But that's actually not the conflict of the story. In the first act of the story, we see Wendy being challenged to move out of the nursery. Her parents are wanting her to grow up. Mm-hmm. And it kind of sets up this turmoil where she's realizing this is my last night here. And Peter Pan, of course, comes in and whisks her away on this final night. So it kind of changes it up where the whole story really is about this inner tension where we know there's this hope that we want to hold on to, but I also have to be an adult at the same time.
Yeah, no doubt about it. So it reminds me, again, of some of the words of educators that I've read over the years. Mm-hmm. And you and I both know people that modeled for us.
Yeah.
You don't have to lose the childlikeness as you mature.
Yeah.
You fully embrace the life station you're in, but you don't lose that sense of trust and wonder. My mom, your grandmother, you call her Nana, never lost this. She passed away about a decade ago. I still miss her to this day. Mm-hmm. But she never lost her sense of innocence, trust, and wonder, even in her 60s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She definitely led the way in our family for
sure.
Yeah. Whenever I think of this topic, I think of her.
Yeah, no doubt about it. So Maya Angelou wrote something very interesting. I'm sure some of our listeners have heard this quote.
Yes.
It's my favorite quote she ever said, even though she said quite a bit. She said, "We are all creative, but by the time we are 3 or 4 years old, someone has knocked the creativity out of us. Some people shut up kids who start to tell stories. Kids dance in their cribs, but someone will insist they sit still. By the time the creative people are 10 or 12, They all want to be like everybody else. That's school. And that's, unfortunately, the story of school. And I love educators, and so do you. You've had many great teachers. But I want you to talk for just a minute about just some of the stuff you've read recently about convergent thinking, divergent thinking, and how school seems to knock the divergent thinking out of us.
Yeah, that's right. I've been reading the book The Artisan Soul by Erwin McManus. I love him as an author, and I love the Mosaic community out there in Los Angeles. But he talks about, towards the end of his book, between these two different terms, divergent thinking and convergent thinking. Just to define those, divergent thinking is when you think outside of the box. You're solving problems, and it's you trying to find the answer through your own creative ingenuity and not through a list of terms on in a book somewhere. That makes sense. But convergent thinking is just following through inside the lines, painting inside the lines, putting thinking inside the box, all of that. But what we're finding out is, maybe many of your listeners are aware of this, is that children are born 95% divergent thinking. They think outside of the box. There is no set rules for them. They can explore, be curious to solve problems in the world.
You're right. If you ask any five-year-old, are you an artist? Oh, yeah, I'm an artist.
That's right.
You know,
that's
or
right.
I'm creative. Yeah, absolutely.
And so 95% of these kids think this way, just naturally.
Yeah.
And there's 5% of them that are convergent in their thinking. But our educational system is built for convergent thinking. We download information. It's a list of facts and figures. When you take a test, you're circling the right answer. And there is only one right answer. There's you don't solve problems. It's very it's tactical. It's more so that way.
Yeah.
So when the educational system flips that ratio, after kids get out of high school, it is no longer 95% divergent thinking. The ratio shifts to 95% convergent thinking and 5% divergent thinking.
So we talked to employers who want to hire recently minted college graduates. They go, I don't see any creativity. Well, we knocked it out of them, like Maya Angelou said.
Right.
So
And what's really, really, really interesting, and he puts this in his book, is that in teams, this 5% of divergent thinkers are usually called the geniuses of the group or the creatives. And it's only because they held on to that divergent thinking.
That's so true.
Yeah.
Well, when we work with your generation, millennials and Gen Z even behind you, they love it when workplaces are fun and creative and zany, because I think we all have that inner longing for that to stay that way. We didn't really like school. Many, not all. And so employers listening, we've got to create space. If this is going to bloom, we've got to create space where creativity can bloom. C.S. Lewis said something interesting. It's one of your favorite quotes. Would you mind reading it? Because I think this kind of comes into play. He talks about childishness, childlikeness, and he says it very, very well.
This is kind of a long quote, but it's worth it because I think it hits on exactly what we're talking about. Here it is. Critics who treat adult as a term of approval instead of as merely a descriptive term cannot be adult to themselves. To be concerned about being grown up, to admire the grown up because it is grown up, to blush at the suspicion of being childish, these things are the marks of childhood and adolescence. And in childhood and adolescence, they are, in moderation, healthy symptoms. Young things ought to want to grow, but to carry on into middle life or even into early manhood, this concern about being adult is a mark of really arrested development. When I was 10, I read fairy tales in secret and would have been ashamed if I was found doing so. Now that I'm 50, I read them openly. When I became a man, I put away childish things, including the fear of childishness and the desire to be very grown up.
C.S. Lewis talks about this very often in the stuff he writes. He recaptures images. Remember, I always start with an image.
Yeah, a picture in his head.
Because it's because it's so it's creative. It's so, Jonathan, before we wrap up this conversation, I feel like you've been so good about describing as a 20-something what it means to maintain childlikeness but still move into an emotionally intelligent adult. And I think you're doing very well, by the way. Can I say that on the air?
Thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome. So when you were growing up, we tried to create some experiences that would be rites of passages, whether they were trips or whatever. We need to keep this brief, but I want you to talk real quick. You and I, when you were about 12 years old, took a trip. In fact, I let you choose wherever you wanted to go in the whole world, and you chose
Minneapolis, Minnesota.
And the reason was?
I heard, see, and this is this innocence, this childlike wonder. I heard there was a roller coaster inside of a mall. Yeah, and I wanted to go there.
That's right. That's
it was all, the mall. That was of the only reason. I could have gone to Egypt. I could have gone. My friends think I was so dumb.
Yeah.
For choosing.
You could have gone to Paris, Hong Kong.
Happened. Yeah, it happened. Yeah.
So we went up there and we had a lot of fun. We did ride the roller coaster in Camp Snoopy.
We did.
More than once, probably. had pillow fights, did things we never told your mom about.
Yes.
But on the last day, we had a conversation. And I'd love to just talk about this because what I was wanting to do is have conversation that would be meaningful and memorable.
Yeah.
And I knew I couldn't just give you a talk over coffee. So you're 12 years old. We drive a car, remember, to that parking lot.
Uh-huh.
And do you want to describe what I did and what you did?
I remember. And so I was 12. So just think about how cool I thought this was. My dad's in the driver's seat of a rental car, mind you.
Yeah.
I'm in the passenger seat. And he says, let's switch places. And I'm like, okay, this is pretty cool. Okay. So we're swapping places. And I got to drive around the parking lot. And the illustration was, I'm moving it out of childhood and becoming a man, and I'm going to become a driver and not a passenger.
Yeah,
and how to be a driver, you're conscious about the people that you're with and staying on the road, minding the signals, minding the signs, and you're having to take responsibility where before you were just the passenger.
And if you remember, we had a little conversation after you, without an accident, parked the car, we switched back and we had a little conversation. And do you remember I asked you the question, how did you first feel when you got behind the wheel? And you said, I was scared. I was panicked. And I said to you, that's exactly how you're going to feel as you become a man. Mm-hmm. You're going to feel like you don't know what you're doing. Yeah. I felt that way. And by the way, in my 20s, I was not sure if I was ready to pay all the bills. Mm-hmm. You just have scary moments where you think, am I ready to do some adulting?
Yep.
But then we talked about how the years that followed 12 years old, your body would be changing, your view of girls would be changing, and it led to a great conversation. And then, if you remember, we went to a graveyard. Mm-hmm. Do you remember that? Do you want to
Which describe? Was very dark, very bleak, of course. But
for a sixth grader.
Yes, right. After I don't know if you parked the car or I parked the car, but we parked the car, finally, we were safe, and we walked through the cemetery, and you began to talk to me about what is your life sentence? What is the thing that you want to be remembered for? So we read the epitaphs of this whole graveyard, and this is what they're summed up by for bystanders that are just walking through the graveyard. Yeah. This is what they're remembered for.
Yeah.
And we talked about what do I want to be remembered for when I'm long gone.
Yeah, and I was so impressed, or really was. I don't know if you've ever heard me say this, but I've spoken to audiences where I've told this story, and I said I had such an impressive conversation with my son about life.
Mm-hmm.
And I was proud of you for the way you talked about wanting to be remembered for something that mattered, not just I was really good on Xbox or whatever was preoccupied.
Which I'm
mind.
Not. I'm not good at epitaph.
Which is probably why that won't show up on your epitaph.
That's true.
Real quick, one last piece. We had a really cool time. There were five of us dads and five sons that were all about the same age, 12 and 13, 14 years old, that did a champion year.
Yeah.
Take a minute and talk about what you remember. That was following the trip, but talk about what you remember, because that was a rite of passage where we tried to introduce topics that you would be facing as a man.
And you know what? That trip to Minneapolis was so great, but there was something about the year that followed, because it was a full year, and it wasn't just a few days where we really got to dig into truths that would follow me into manhood, which was so good. But it was a group of boys and their dads, and we brought in different guests. So we brought in an army general. I remember that was huge. He like had his badges on, and all of us were like, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And he just told us about self-discipline. And that spoke so loud and clear from a military man just standing there in our room.
Yeah.
So there were just messages that came in loud and clear that year, made it so experiential and really guided the way.
Yeah, and we talked about courage, we talked about honor, we talked about attitude, mental toughness, expelled the word champion. But the cool thing was, at the end, we had, even though we're not Hebrew, we're not Jewish, we had a bar mitzvah, we had a little bit of a celebration. Do you remember that, and could you talk just real quick from memory?
Well, of course, for 12-year-old kids, you guys used a lot of stuff that we thought were cool.
Yeah.
So to kind of illustrate our gifts and the things that we learned that year, the dads were so great to like, I think one of the dads hired a superhero animator or something.
Yes,
he designed our own superheroes. You asked what I remembered. That's what I remember.
Yeah.
And you gave us swords, united us. So this sounds cheesy, but for our group, especially having gone through it, we were like, this is really, we remembered it.
Captain Create.
Yes, I was. Yes, I was. It's hanging up in my room. Yes, I was.
So that was cool. Now, you know what I just remembered? We had the celebration, but before we had the celebration, remember we had the knighting ceremony.
Yeah.
Do you mind talking about that?
Well, they lit up these torches around the house like it was Survivor.
It was awesome.
Yes, it was really cool. It was very experiential. And so like all the boys like got quiet, like there was this sacred moment because it was. And
yeah.
Each of the dads came to each of us, spoke into our lives. And
yeah, we read a letter to you.
You read a letter to each of us. Specifically calling out things from Evan, things from Nick, things from Jonathan, all the boys that you saw in us that year. Yeah. And it was really, really meaningful. And then you knighted us.
That's right. We had a 42-inch sword that we touched
it's
both
so
shoulders.
So heavy.
That's right.
It's
it was awesome.
Still heavy.
We said, we're giving our 12-year-old boys a weapon now. Is that really smart?
Yes.
Well, that's right. Yeah. So, but that was fun. Yeah. And even though it was borderline cheesy, but I think you're right. At your station, it was, I mean, you had that thing hanging in your room for a while, that sword.
Yeah.
So anyway, what my hope was in that experience as the father, as an adult in the life of a kid who's moving into adolescence, was allowing you to see gripping manhood can be cool and it can be good.
Yeah.
And we don't have to lose our child likeness, but we do need to choose our childishness. We need to move into maturation where we're playing a role as a citizen in our community.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah. Jonathan, thank you for joining us today. Yeah. I love you. You know that.
Uh-huh.
And it was great to dialogue with you.
Tim and Jonathan, thank you so much. Before we dive into the practical application part of the podcast, if you'd like to learn more about the topic, Dr. Elmore's newest book called Marching Off the Map can be found at growingleaders.com. Tim, one of our favorite parts of the podcast is when you get to just talk about us, about practical applications to the discussion that we've had. Talk to us about how teachers, parents can apply the conversation that you and Jonathan just had.
Thanks, Mary. This is really an important subject. And of course, parents probably readily identified with what Jonathan and I just talked about. But I'd like to focus now on the educators, the coaches, the employers that are listening that say, my young are not in my house, but they're in front of me every day. Educators for decades now have measured growth in four categories: cognitive growth, biological growth, social, and then emotional growth. Kids today, as we look at the numbers, are cognitively advanced, biologically advanced. We're turning out better specimens than ever before on that football field, but often socially and emotionally behind. So there is a term that's kind of a hot button in education right now: social-emotional learning. We've got to find ways beyond reading, writing, and arithmetic to grow these kids so they're not childish when they're 28 or 29. They're ready to get married or they're ready to play a role as a citizen in our communities. So may I just encourage you to work on social-emotional learning. And this might mean creating experiences in your classroom that enable them to interact with others. Nothing worse than saying, well, he's great at math, but don't put him with people. Well, they're going to have to be with people in their career. So those social and emotional muscles can be built at home and at school. My wife and I, for instance, would have parties in our home. I've alluded to this before. And we'd have our children at 8 and 12 years old host those parties for grown-ups. So in school, I love it when teachers create experiences where kids are simulating what it means to pay bills and to interact with others, where they have a sum of money that they're spending or investing, and they interact, and there's some conflict that they need to resolve, and the teacher doesn't resolve it for them. Athletic coaches, there's all kinds of social-emotional learning that needs to take place among teammates. Are we building good teammates? This really focuses on a term that we've used before in this podcast, but it's metacognition. It's pushing them, the young, to do the thinking on their own, to engage and own the projects, where you're not just giving them answers, but you're having them come up with the answers. Perhaps one way you do this is you teach some material, you put them in small groups, and you say, now I want each small group to prepare to teach this to another group, where they're having to own and engage in the subject. The fact is, in this podcast, if nothing else came out, I hope it came out that our world today makes it tougher to experience authentic maturity. And in the book Marching Off the Map, which Mary alluded to, we actually offer a game plan for educators to lead students into holistic maturation to be ready for adulthood, to scrap the childishness and but yet maintain the childlikeness. That's my hope for every listener today, whether you're a parent, teacher, coach, employer, that you help the kids that are in front of you grow holistically as they age.
Great. Thanks, Tim, so much for the insight and those practical steps. To our listeners, thank you for joining us at the Growing Leaders Podcast, and we'll see you next time.